Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Friday, November 1st edition of Money Matters, the program all about money, how we earn it, how we spend it, how we save it, and how we invest it. I'm Jeff Eisman, and today I'll be reading from a recent edition of Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. The first article is one that has been in the news lately because of financial situations within families. And the headline reads, Smart Ways to Give or Lend Money to Family. Keep good records and don't hand over money you can't afford to lose. And it's an article by Eileen Ambrose. Parents spend more than $500 billion annually assisting young adults with student loans, housing, groceries, car payments, cell phone bills, and other expenses, according to a recent Merrill study. For many families, that largesse is in the form of a gift, but some parents may call it a loan and treat the transaction as a lesson in money management. When gifting or lending is done right, it can help young adults get a first home, a car, or a college education that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford. Or the money may be just what a relative needs to get back on his feet. But done wrong, handouts can undermine a young adult's independence and generate hard feelings among other family members who don't get gifts or loans. If it's a loan that's never repaid, whether you wrote the check or co-signed for a loan from a lender, it may create a lasting rift with the borrower and potentially leave black marks on your credit history. Giving or lending money can also affect your lifestyle and retirement plans. Jennifer Myers, a certified financial planner in McLean, Virginia, says she usually runs projections for clients on how a potential gift or a loan that might never be repaid might affect their ability to retire when they want. You have to make sure you can afford to help that family member or friend and still be financially secure yourself, she says. But Myers acknowledges that it's hard to say no to someone you love. A lot of times, people follow their heart and put their finances second, she says. Lending or giving money to a family to family members can be rewarding, but you need to be aware of the risks. Here are some smart ways to give or lend money without sacrificing family harmony. Many parents worry that giving money to an offspring will spoil the child's ambition or drive, says Ryan Thomas, a certified financial planner in Indianapolis. It's human nature that you don't appreciate it as much if you didn't work for it, he says. To avoid this, parents can require a commitment from the child. For example, parents who have saved enough for college can encourage students to apply for scholarships, which often require maintaining a high GPA, by promising to match the amount of scholarships awarded after graduation, Thomas says. Or parents can help young adults build a nest egg by reimbursing the money they put in a Roth IRA or 401k once they've provided proof of their contributions. As far as making a loan, never lend more money than you can afford to lose. You hope you are going to get the money back, but you always have to go into a family loan with the notion that you might not see the money again, says Myers. Make loans a business transaction. Memories fade, and to avoid disputes over whether the money was a gift or a loan, write the terms, including the amount, repayment schedule, and any interest to be charged, in a promissory note, and have both sides sign it. Loans that aren't documented are often not repaid. That's what Alex Tran, a digital marketing strategist in Seattle, found. She lent $500 to a relative 11 years ago, but was never repaid despite her efforts to collect. After that, whenever she lent money, she drew up a contract with the loan terms. She made about 10 loans and hasn't had one go bad since creating those contracts. It looks professional and also keeps them accountable for returning the money, says Tran. Another reason to put loans in writing, if you're not repaid, you could deduct the loss on your tax return as a bad debt, says Blake Christian, a CPA with the accounting firm HCVT in Park City, Utah. The IRS is absolutely going to scrutinize any bad debt, he says. The agency also requires you to document your efforts to collect the money. The IRS will assume that a family loan is a gift unless you can prove otherwise, says Mark Luscombe, principal analyst for Wolters Kluwer Tax and Accounting. To avoid issues with the IRS, document the loan and charge interest on large loans, he says. You're not required to charge interest if the loan is for less than $10,000 and won't be used to purchase an investment, or up to $1,000 if the borrower's investment income for the year is less than $1,000. The IRS offers guidance on interest rates. Each month, it publishes a minimum amount of interest called the applicable federal rates that must be assessed on new private loans depending on the duration of the loan. In June, the annual interest rate was 2.33% on loans for 3 years or less, 2.38% on loans for up to 9 years, and 2.76% for longer loans. You must report the interest income on your tax return. To get the most recent AFRs, go to the www.irs.gov website and, of course, search for applicable federal rates. If you'd prefer to make it a gift, you may also be able to use the tax code to your advantage. Although cash is nice, you might save on taxes by giving appreciated securities instead, if your income is higher than the recipient's. The federal long-term capital gains tax rate for investments held more than a year can be as high as 23.8%, depending on your income. But if the recipient's income is low enough, the gains on the sale of securities could be taxed at a rate of 15% or even 0%. And what about if you're just giving for a more practical reason? If they were a business, friends and family would be the seventh largest mortgage lender in the U.S., according to a recent study sponsored by Legal & General, a financial services company. Sylvia Wu, 30, of Kailua, Oahu, bought a $210,000 condo as an investment property while in college in 2009 with the help of her parents, who saw the weakened housing market as a prime opportunity. Wu says she had $35,000 for the down payment, but she couldn't qualify for a mortgage because she worked only part-time. Her parents borrowed against their home and lent $175,000 to Wu so she could buy the condo outright. Her mother drew up a promissory note with the terms. Wu, now an education specialist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, used rental income from the condo and her paycheck to repay the debt with interest. Her parents provided a similar loan to Wu's sister. My sister and I are totally fine with making this arrangement very formalized and paying interest to my mom, says Wu. The easiest way to help a family member with a home purchase is to provide the down payment as a gift. You'll need to supply recent bank statements and a gift letter signed by you and the home buyer that verifies the money isn't a loan that must be repaid, says Rick Bechtel, head of the residential lending at TD Bank. If you want to lend money to help finance part of the home purchase, the process is more complicated. A lender will take into account the monthly debt payment due you when deciding whether the home buyer can qualify for a mortgage, says Bechtel. Whether your loan will cover just part of the purchase or the full amount, documentation will be key. Besides creating the promissory note, many parents also opt to file a mortgage or deed of trust with their local government, such as the registrar of deeds or the county clerk's office. Creating a lien on the property, says Timothy Burke, founder and CEO of National Family Mortgage, which helps administer loans between immediate family members. This step is necessary if the homeowner wants to deduct the mortgage interest she pays you, says Burke. The lien also protects you in case of default. You could foreclose, although your loan would be second in line for repayment if the homeowner has a first mortgage with a lender, and it would be difficult to make such a decision with a child or other relative. A lawyer, in some states a title company attorney, can help you draw up the promissory note and file the paperwork. National Family Mortgage can also help you create and service the loan. The company can set up the promissory note, help with the filing and necessary paperwork with local authorities, manage the payments, send out late payment notices if needed, and generate year-end IRS tax forms. The cost, depending on the size of the loan, is a one-time fee ranging from $725 to $2,100, plus a minimum of $15 a month for servicing the loan. And now we're moving into a section that's titled The Risks of Co-Signing. Many college students who have maxed out on federal student loans turn to private loans to fill the gaps, but they usually need a co-signer to qualify. This can have repercussions for that co-signer. If the primary borrower doesn't repay, the co-signer is responsible for the debt. Plus, a co-signer's credit history can be damaged if the borrower misses payments or makes them late, says Jeremy Heckman, a certified financial planner in Edina, Minnesota. You might not be aware of the problem until you apply for credit, says Heckman, who discourages clients from co-signing on any loan. But some people put their credit on the line with their eyes wide open. Phil LeDuc, 56, of Allen Park, Michigan, agreed to co-sign private student loans for his daughter, Jennifer. I made a commitment to her early on. You worry about getting into the best school you possibly can, and we'll figure out how to finance it, he says, adding that he expected to help her repay the loans all along. She was accepted at Loyola University Chicago, where she graduated in 2009 with degrees in journalism and English, and $145,000 in private loans. Jennifer found a job as an editor at a trade publication and was making loan payments until she was laid off in late 2010. Her dad continued the payments, and now about half of the debt has been repaid. LeDuc, a safety consultant and author of workplace safety books, says he would have a more comfortable retirement if the money had gone into his savings instead, but he has no regrets about investing in his daughter's future. I can't think of a better way to spend my money, he says. Jennifer, who's 32, has been working in early childhood education for the past 9 years and plans to go back to school this fall to get a master's degree in the field. This time, she says, she anticipates that a scholarship and an employer assistance program will cover nearly all of the tuition. I feel like I learned my lesson with my undergraduate degree, she says. I don't think I'm going to ask my father for any money. And then you should also be aware of the tax limits. You can give up to $15,000 a year to an individual without having to file any gift tax return. Married couples can give a total of $30 per person. Any sum over the limit over that limit chips away at the amount you'll be able to exempt from federal estate and gift tax. This is likely not an issue for many, given that an individual can now exempt up to $11.4 million in lifetime gifts and bequests from federal gift and estate taxes. There are ways to give higher amounts without having to file a gift tax return, however. You can pay a student's tuition directly to the school or help with a relative's medical bills and health insurance premiums by making payments directly to the hospital, doctor, or insurer, says Christian. Besides estate and other tax issues, parents often grapple with guilt and worries about family harmony. When parents give or lend money to one child, siblings may feel resentful. Being upfront with family members about why you're providing assistance can help prevent those ill feelings, says Heckman. For instance, parents can explain that they are giving one child the down payment for a house and will do the same for the others when they're ready to buy, he says. Some parents and grandparents try to balance things out by making equal gifts to other family members at the same time. Others make things fair through their estate documents. If one child is given $50,000 to, say, buy a home or pay for grad school, that child's inheritance will be reduced by that amount and adjusted for inflation. So, It's always a tricky matter, lending or gifting money to family members. Not everybody's always happy, but hopefully perhaps there's some tips there that can help with that situation if you're ever faced with it. All right, we're going to move on now to the next article. And this article is entitled, it's for the younger folks out there who may be listening. It's under the Millennial Money section of the magazine. And the headline reads, The Talk Before Moving In Together. It's by Caitlin Pitzker of the Kiplinger staff. Millennials are waiting longer than previous generations to get married, but that doesn't mean we're navigating our finances solo. About 30% of millennials are married, and about 15% of people aged 25 to 34 live with an unmarried partner, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Married or not, for most couples, managing money eventually becomes, at least in part, a team endeavor. You don't have to divulge every dollar, debt, and detail when you start dating, but if you're moving toward a future together, you need to cover the basics. Start with upfront conversations about income, goals, spending, and debt. Even if you're not combining any accounts for now, or maybe ever, a partner's finances can affect yours. For example, one low credit score can impact a couple's ability to rent an apartment together or qualify for a mortgage. As your situation changes, consider your plan for sharing expenses, how you save for shared goals, and more. Talking about money is often one of the most uncomfortable parts of a relationship, says Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com. But most experts recommend that couples schedule money meetings at least once a month. Think of them as money dates, and use the time to review budgets, check in on goals, and revise the approach to your lives as relationships change. Couples who are just starting out or who want to maintain more individual control often keep their finances firmly divided. My boyfriend Justin and I spent last summer culling our possessions as we moved in together and made the shared space a home for both of us. For now, we share household expenses and information about our finances, but separate accounts that, but separate accounts will still work best for us. In time, we'll likely combine some things while maintaining small individual accounts for personal discretionary spending. If you're splitting shared expenses, consider each person's income and other liabilities. If one person earns significantly more than the other, you may want to divide shared bills proportionally, a 60-40 split, for example. To streamline payments for shared expenses, you may want to open a joint checking account where each month you both contribute enough to cover rent and other household expenses. Limiting that account to cover the most of shared expenses, keeping separate credit cards, and waiting to buy a home together are particularly smart moves for unmarried couples because they don't benefit from the same legal protection as married couples do. Eventually, you may merge most of your accounts, draft one shared budget, and set guidelines for how much each partner can spend without checking in with the other first. For most couples, sharing finances isn't an all-or-nothing deal. And over time, your relationship evolves, and your financial strategy will likely change too, or should. Long-term, I often recommend a yours, mine, and ours approach, says Britton Gregory, a certified financial planner in Austin, Texas. All income goes into a joint account that covers shared expenses, including the rent or mortgage, groceries, utilities, and other agreed-upon items. Also drawn from the shared account, an agreed-upon amount of or percentage of income transferred to individual accounts for each partner's personal or discretionary spending. To prevent one partner from running up debt the other isn't aware of, Gregory suggests couples use a shared credit card for the joint account, but stick to debit cards for their individual accounts. Yeah, juggling those money issues with a close significant other or spouse is a tough thing at the beginning, and some of that makes perfect sense, I think. Okay, moving on to the next article. This article is in regard to investments, and the headline reads, Opportunity Knocks. A new type of fund gives investors a tax break, but it's not for everyone. This is an article by Ryan Ermey of the Kiplinger staff. The prospect of investing in dilapidated inner-city neighborhoods or tumbleweed-ridden rural towns may not excite most investors, but a program embedded in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act offers investors a tax incentive to do just that. As a result, a new type of fund that invests in low-income communities has popped up, and investors and institutions alike are starting to take notice. You've probably heard of Opportunity Zones. If you're wealthy enough, you may have received a pitch to invest in an Opportunity Zone fund. These new investments sound appealing, but they're not for everyone. The new OZ funds pool money from multiple investors and invest in businesses and real estate development projects located in economically distressed communities that the federal government has designated as in need of investment. The more than 8,700 opportunity zones include parts of nearly every major American city, including Chicago and Los Angeles, as well as all of Puerto Rico and remote towns in Alaska. Investors who put money in OZ funds can defer and eventually reduce taxable capital gains depending on how long they stay invested. The tax benefits apply only to capital gains, but it's a threefold incentive. First, you can defer federal capital gains tax on money you've earned from another investment by putting it into an OZ fund. Say you sell shares in a stock and realize $100,000 of capital gain. If within 180 days you roll over the $100,000 gain into an OZ fund, you can defer paying capital gains tax on it until you sell your stake in the fund or until December 31st of 2026, whichever comes first. The idea is to encourage investors to sell existing investments and invest the proceeds in an OZ fund. Second, the longer you hold your investment in the fund, the more you can reduce the amount of rolled-over gain that will be subject to tax. Investors who hold the fund for 5 years get a 10% reduction on the gain they'll owe taxes on. Hold for 7 years and you'll get another 5% reduction. For example, an investor who rolls $100,000 of capital gains from a previous investment into an OZ fund would owe capital gains tax on only $90,000 if she sold after 5 years and on only $85,000 after 7 years. No matter when you invest, however, the December 2026 date is set in stone, says Fraser Rice, senior wealth strategist at Kalamos Wealth Management. For the 2026 tax year, whether you sell or hold your investment in the OZ fund, you must pay any federal capital gains tax you owe on the profits you rolled into the OZ fund. Hold for 10 years or more, and a third benefit kicks in. Any gain in your investment in the fund is tax-free, as long as your outlay was made with capital gains from a prior investment. Some funds require that you hold for 10 years, but the vast majority allow you to sell at any time. Since the Tax Act passed, 130 qualified OZ funds have opened, according to the National Council of State Housing Agencies, a nonprofit focused on affordable housing. It maintains a directory of OZ funds on its website, www.ncsha.org. The funds, which range in asset size from less than $1 million to $3 billion, are run mostly by money management firms and real estate developers. A fund from the developer H.H. Kirby Real Estate Ventures, for example, aims to transform a former cotton mill in Burlington, North Carolina, into a complex with a live event center, restaurants, and sports facilities. The North Country Opportunity Zone Fund, run by American AG Energy, a company that builds greenhouses, invests in agricultural facilities in Berlin, New Hampshire. As interest ramps up, high net worth investors may see OZ funds offered at bigger money management firms such as Charles Schwab or Merrill Lynch, says Tim Steffen of Baird Private Wealth Management. But not everyone can buy in. With most OZ funds, you must be an accredited investor. That is, you must have a net worth of at least $1 million, excluding your primary residence, or have two consecutive years of at least $200,000 in annual income if you're a single tax filer, and $300,000 for married filers. Most funds come with a six-figure investment minimum, too. Fee structures tend to mimic those of hedge funds and private equity investment. Investors pay an annual fee of 1.5 to 2.0% in expenses, and when they sell, fork over another 20% of any excess return a fund earns above an amount promised to the investor. The typical promised rate of return is about 6 to 10% for funds with diversified portfolios, and more for funds that invest in a single project. It's too early to say what kind of gains, if any, these OZ funds will deliver, or which OZ funds are worth investments. In fact, the rules on what an OZ fund can invest in and how it should operate are still evolving. That can pose a problem. An OZ fund must comply with myriad IRS guidelines. If it doesn't, it may have to pay a penalty, or worse, the fund's investors won't be eligible for the capital gains tax breaks. With little track records and inexperienced management, high fees, and high hurdle to entry, OZ funds are not right for retirement savings or money you can't stand to lose or lock up for the required holding periods. They're geared for deep-pocketed, savvy investors than mom-and-pop savers. If you've never invested in private equity or a closely held investment in which you're a minority investor, says Smith, these probably aren't for you. Not to mention the fact that they're kind of risky, I would think, in those opportunity zones, because as the economy is shaky, so too is the opportunity in those zones, I would think, but that's just me. Well, that brings us to the end of our time today. As usual, you can reach us here at WRRS with any comments or questions you might have. Our number is 513-487-4245. This has been Jeff Eisman for Money Matters. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great weekend.